Thank you for listening to a reading presented by the Poetry Center of Chicago. The Poetry Center is an independent, nonprofit arts organization promoting poetry in Chicago through readings, workshops, and arts education. To learn more about the Poetry Center, to read poems by our students in Chicago Public Schools, or to donate, please visit www.poetrycenter.org.
Good evening. On behalf of the Poetry Center, welcome to the reading by Kenneth Koch and Dean Young. I have a few announcements to make before we start. Tomorrow, Kenneth Koch will give a free workshop for teachers. If any of you is interested, whether you are a teacher or not, if you're interested in teaching poetry to children, it's designed for elementary school teachers. It's free. It's at Jones Academic Magnet School, which is at 606 South State Street, just on the other side of the Congress Expressway. If you are interested, we need to have you register, and you do that by just calling the Poetry Center, 899-7483. We're in the book, in case you don't write it down. Also, the next reading on Wednesday, March 29th, will feature the novelist Frederick Bush and the poet Kay Ryan. Thank you for coming. I introduce Mark Perlberg.
They move the stairs. Such is life. You never know what's going to happen. Thank you for coming. I'm a member of the board of the Poetry Center. And before I introduce David Wojon, who will speak to you about tonight's guests, I want to say a word about the woman for whom this annual reading is named, the late Martha Friedberg. And I'm happy to say that some of Martha's relatives and friends are in the audience tonight. Martha was one of the founders of the Poetry Center, which is celebrating its 25th anniversary this season. This makes the center by far the longest-running reading series open to the general public in the city's history. It's no exaggeration to say that one of the reasons why we have reached our majority and beyond is that Martha was a generous patron of the center and one of its chief guiding spirits. Martha was a woman of wit, sophistication, and great kindness, and she was an excellent poet who published 3 books of poems, each beautifully illustrated with woodcuts. She would be delighted to know that Kenneth Koch and Dean Young will be reading under her banner tonight. And may I now introduce David Wojon, distinguished poet and critic and director of the University of Indiana's writing program, who will speak to us about tonight's poets. David.
It's a great pleasure to introduce to you 2 poets tonight, one of whom may be the most inventive and original poet of my own generation, and one of whom is one of the most inventive and original poets at work today, period. Dean Young is the author of 4 collections of poetry, Design with X and Beloved Infidel, which were published by Wesleyan, Strike Anywhere, which was the winner of the Colorado Prize in Poetry, and First Course in Turbulence, which appeared from Pittsburgh last year. He's received fellowships from the NEA, the Fine Arts Work Center, and from Stanford, a Stegner Fellowship. His poems have appeared in many journals and anthologies, and he's a professor of English here in Chicago at Loyola University. You don't so much enter a poem by Dean Young as you get hurled there. And once you can collect your thoughts and survey your surroundings, you find a world that is in some ways dependably familiar, but in other and more frequent ways, utterly strange, and where frightening and serendipitous events present themselves by turns. This is to say, he understands the workings of the surrealist aesthetic better than almost any poet born since 1950, understands its world of dream and chance and ecstasy and nightmare, and understands how that world superimposes itself on this world relentlessly and often when you least expect it. It is a world you wouldn't want to inhabit for long, but if you had to inhabit it, you'd find in Dean Young the most dependable and knowing guide to its geography, and the sort of guide you can immediately trust. He's always showing you something interesting. He has an uncanny ability to imagine new metaphors and striking associations and a brilliant sense of comic timing. But most important of all, he possesses a big-hearted generosity of spirit, the kind of compassionate vision that is a rare thing in contemporary poetry. The world he must guide you through makes no sense at all, and it is often a brutal world, but he proves to you again and again that he's the very best Sherpa you will ever find. Or maybe he's your Virgil. Whatever he is, he knows that, as he puts it in one of his poems, we are clouds and terrible things happen in clouds. Kenneth Koch, as David Lehman reminds us, is our funniest poet. But Koch has had what Lehman calls the misfortune to be a comic poet when the lyric poem is the be-all and end-all of verse, and is mistakenly held to be incompatible with the spirit of comedy. In other words, the problem lies with us and not with Kenneth Koch. And to read his poems in the way they should be read, you have to realign many of your notions, many of the notions you've been taught about poetry, all the pieties you've grown to accept from critics and the period style. And instead remember what it was that probably attracted you to poetry in the first place. When you read Koch, you remember that poetry arises first from delight, and that it is wrong for poetry to end in wisdom, but in that process, abandon delight. Stevens said that one of the requirements for poetry, which made it the supreme fiction, is that it must give pleasure. Most of our poems today do not give pleasure, neither for their readers nor for their writers, but Kenneth Koch's poems surely do, and have done so dependably for some 50 years. They give you pleasure because of their mastery of invention, both in regard to their giddy command of parody and comedy, and also to their use of form, for he is one of the most gifted prosodists of our time, whether he is shaping a list poem or writing in strict couplets. The poems give you pleasure while at the same time instructing you, and in efforts such as his magnificent long poems, The Art of Love and The Art of Poetry, you hear echoes of great classical masters of instruction, such as Horace and Ovid. And you, of course, can also see how pleasure and instruction are connected when you read Koch's legendary educational works. Wishes, Lies, and Dreams, his account of teaching children to write poetry, has no doubt created more poets and readers of poetry than the Iowa Writers Workshop ever will. And Koch continues to be an active teacher of poetry at Columbia. He is the author of 16 books of verse, 2 collections of fiction, and several works for theater. He has won many awards and honors, among them the Bollingen Prize. As he writes in the beginning of his poem, Nights and Days, it came to me that all this time there had been no real poetry and that it had to be invented. Well, this is exactly the problem that Kenneth Koch has set out to solve, and he has done so brilliantly.
I'm going to read all poems from my. I'm going to read all poems from my new book, which comes out in April, called "New Addresses." All of these poems take the rhetorical form, which I think is called apostrophe. In any case, they're all talking to something that can't answer, like the west wind, the ocean. You'll see what they're addressed to. In any case, they're all in that form. To the word yes. You are always the member of a team accompanied by a question. If this is the way the world ends, is it really going to? No. Are you a Buddhist? Maybe. A monsoon? Yes. I have been delighted by you even in the basement when asking if I could have some coal lumps, and the answer was yes. Yes to the finality of the brightness and to the enduring qualities of the lark. She sings at heaven's gate. But is it unbolted? Bolted? Yes. Which, though, is which? to which the answer cannot be yes, so reverse question. Pamela, bending before the grate, turns round rapidly to say, yes, I will meet you in Boston at 9:05 if my Irishness is still working. And the global hamadryads, wood nymphs of my yes. But what, Pamela, what does that mean? Am I a yes to be posed in the face of a negative alternative? Or has the sky taken away from me its ultimate guess about how probably everything is going to be eventually terrible, which is something we knew all along, being modified by a yes, when what we want is obvious, but has a brilliantly shining trail of stars, or are those asterisks, yes? What is at the bottom of the most overt question? Do we die? Yes. Does that always come later than now? Yes. I love your development from the answer to a simple query to a state of peace that has the world by the throat. Am I lying? Yes. Are you smiling? Yes. I'll follow you, yes? No reply. Is that booming I hear? Are you hearing that from the microphone? I don't know what to do about it. Perhaps stay away from it. Can you hear me as well now? I'll never stop hearing the booming. In any case, okay. The next poem is called To Life. All one can say with certainty about anything that has you is it moves. Hey, wait a minute. Look, it's moving. Look at it. It's moving. It must have life. No, no, that's only an electric charge. It's attached to a battery. No, that's life. The wind blew it halfway across the street or from one edge of the table to another. It's not alive. Yes, it is. It moved by itself. It has life. It's starting on a journey or is in the middle of one or near the end. Is it you who fill me up so? Is it you who are carrying me away? Tell me how you managed to do that, also with all the other people. You must be very busy, very powerful and manic. Why do you want to keep up such a huge organization? What ought one to do in you and with you? You give rocky lessons at best. It would be good to find out from you if you have some purpose, aside from seeming meaningless to adolescents and appearing marvelous beyond all accounting to those who are in love. You're famous for being horrible, wonderful, irreplaceable, and also incomprehensible. I read Raymond Roussel trying to figure you out. I read Stendhal and Henry Green and Italo Svevo and listen to Don Giovanni. In the Greek torso I find you, but you aren't there. Without you there's no suffering and no dancing at the beach. I have no husband, says the would-be bride, but she has you. I feel like a tennis player changing his racket, but I had the long-distance glasses on. To my father's business. Leo bends over his desk, gazing at a memorandum, while Stuart stands beside him with a smile, saying, Leo, the order for those desks came in today from Youngstown Needle and Thread. Seeloth Incorporated, there you are, like Balboa the Conqueror of those who want to buy office furniture or bar fixtures in 1940 in Cincinnati, Ohio. Secretaries pound out invoices on antique typewriters, dactylographs, and fingernail biters. I am sitting on a desk looking at my daddy, who is proud of but feels unsure about some aspects of his little laddie. I will go on to explore deep and or nonsensical themes while my father's on the dark hardwood floor hit by a couple of Ohio sunbeams. Kenny, he says, someday you'll work in the store. But I felt, never more. Or never ever. Harvard was far away. World War II was distant. Psychoanalysis was extremely expensive. All of these saved me from you. Seeloth, you made my father happy. I saw his face shining. He laughed a lot, working in you. He said to Miss Ritter, his secretary, Rit, this is my boy, Kenny. Hello there, Kenny, she said. My heart in an uproar. I loved you, but couldn't think of staying with you. I can see the virtues now that could come from being in you. A sense of balance, compromise, and acceptance. Not isolated moments of brilliance like a girl without a shoe, but someone that you care for every day. Need for customers and the economy don't go away. There were little pamphlets distributed in you about success in business, each about 8 to 12 pages long. One whole series of them all ended with the words, P.S., he got the job. One, a story about a boy who said, I swept up the street, sir, before you got up. Or, there were 500 extra catalogs, so I took them to people in the city who have a dog. P.S., he got the job. I didn't get the job. I didn't think that I could do the job. I thought I might go crazy in the job, staying in you, you whom I could love, but not be part of. The secretaries clicked their Smith Coronas closed at 5 p.m. and took the streetcars to Kentucky then, and I left too. I have to switch to the manuscript because in the bound galleys there's some mistakes. To stammering. Where did you come from, lamentable quality? Before I had a life, you were about to ruin my life. The mystery of this stays with me. Don't brood about things, my elders said. I hadn't any other experience of enemies from inside. They were all from outside. Big boys who cursed me and hit me, motorists, falling trees. All these you were as bad as, yet inside. When I spoke, you were there. I could avoid you by singing or by acting. I acted in school plays, but was no good at singing. Immediately after the play, you were there again. You ruined the cast party. You were not a sign of confidence. You were not a sign of manliness. You were stronger than good luck and bad. You survived them both. You were slowly edged out of my throat by psychoanalysis. You who had been brought in, it seems, like a hired thug to beat up both sides and distract them from the main issue, Oedipal love. You were horrible. Tell them, now that you're back in your thug country, that you don't have to be so rough the next time you're called in, but can be milder and have the same effect, unhappiness and pain. To kidding around. Kidding around, you are terrible sometimes when I feel that I have to do it. Suddenly behaving like an ape, piling up snow on top of a friend when I know that isn't going to win her heart. Screaming for no reason, very loud, eating in a noisy way, running and barking as if I were a dog through the dimly lighted streets, frightening the inhabitants, bashing myself into the cutouts or mannequins in a store window display, and yelling, Buffo! I am having so much fun, seemingly. But isn't this a faithless seeming? For I'm a joker, an ass, and I can't stop being ridiculous. My tongue against the window, vlop, vlap, I can't get it loose, it's frozen there. How can I ever say what's in my heart while imitating the headbutts of a rhinoceros or the arm spans of an octopus? I'm nothing but a wretched clown, all manner of humiliating things, like a far-off landscape, icy women who loom like towers. Yet sometimes you're breathtaking kidding around, to be rid of the troubles of one person by turning into someone else, moving and jolting as if nothing mattered but today, in fact, nothing but this precise moment, 5:31 a.m., celery growing on the plains, snow swirls in the mountains. The next poem is called To World War II. Early on, you introduced me to young women in bars, made me in San Luis Obispo drunk on French 75s, in Los Angeles on pousse cafes. It was a time of general confusion, of being a body hurled at a wall. I didn't do much fighting. I sat, rather I stood, in a foxhole. I stood while the typhoon splashed us into morning. It felt unusual, even if for a good cause, to be part of a destructive force, with my rifle in my hands, and in my head my serial number. The entire object of my existence, to eliminate Japanese soldiers by killing them with a rifle or with a grenade. And then many years after that, I could write poetry, fall in love, and have a daughter, and think about these things from a great distance, if I survived. I was paying my debt to society, a paid killer. It wasn't like anything I'd done before on the paved streets of Cincinnati or on the ballroom floor at Mr. Vathay's dancing class. What would Anne Marie Goldsmith have thought of me if instead of asking her to dance, I had put my BAR to my shoulder and shot her in the face? I thought about her in my foxhole. One in a foxhole near me has his throat cut during the night. We take more precautions, but it is night, and it is you. The typhoon continues, and so do you. I can't be killed because of my poetry. I have to live in order to write it, I thought. Even crazier thought, or just as crazy, if I'm killed while thinking of lines, it will be too corny when it's reported. I imagined it would be reported. So I kept thinking of lines of poetry. One that came to me on the beach on Leyte was, "The surf comes in like masochistic lions." I loved this terrible line. It was keeping me alive. My Uncle Leo wrote to me, "You won't believe this, but someday you may wish you were footloose and 20 on Leyte again." I have never wanted to be on Leyte again. With you whispering into my ear, "Go on and win me. Tomorrow you may not be alive, so do it today." How could anyone ever win you? How many persons would I have had to kill, even to begin to be a part of winning you? You were too much for me, though I was older than you were, and in camouflage. But for you who threw everything together and had all the systems working for you all the time, this was trivial. If you could use me, you'd use me, and then forget. How else did I think you'd behave? I'm glad you ended. I'm glad I didn't die or lose my mind. As machines make ice, we made dead enemy soldiers in dark jungle alleys with weapons in our hands that produced fire and kept going straight through. I was carrying one. I, who had gone about for years as a child, praying God, "Don't let there ever be another war, or if there is, don't let me be in it." Well, I was in you. All you cared about was existing and being one. You died of a bomb blast in Nagasaki, and there were parades. This is called To My Twenties. How lucky that I ran into you when everything was possible for my legs and arms, and with hope in my heart, and so happy to see any woman, oh woman, oh my 20th year, basking in you, you oasis from both growing and decay, fantastic, unheard of, 9 or 10 year oasis, a palm tree, hay, and then another, and another, and water. I'm still very impressed by you. Whither midst falling decades have you gone? Oh, in what lucky fellow, unsure of himself, upset and unemployable for the moment in any case, do you live now? From my window I drop a nickel by mistake. With you I race down to get it. But I find there on the street instead a good friend, XN, who says to me, "Kenneth, do you have a minute?" And I say, "Yes, I'm in my 20s. I have plenty of time." In you I marry. In you I first go to France. I make my best friends in you and a few enemies. I write a lot, and I'm living all the time and thinking about living. I love to frequent you after my teens and before my 30s. You three together in a bar, I always preferred you because you were midmost, most lustrous, apparently strongest. Although now that I look back on you, what part have you played? You never, ever were stingy. What you gave me, you gave whole. But as for telling me how best to use it, you weren't a genius at that. 20s, my soul is yours for the asking. You know that if you ever come back. To psychoanalysis. I took the Lexington Avenue subway to arrive at you in your glory days of the 1950s, when we believed that you could solve any problem. And I had nothing but disdain for self-analysis, group analysis, Jungian analysis, Adlerian analysis, the Karen Horney kind, all other than you, pure Freudian type, despicable, and never to be mine. I would lie down according to your dictates, but not go to sleep. I would free associate. I would say whatever came into my head. Great troops of animals floated through, and certain characters, like Picasso and Einstein. Whatever came into my head or my heart, through reading or thinking or talking, came forward once again in you. I took voyages down deep, unconscious rivers, fell through fields, cleft rocks, went on through hurricanes and volcanoes. Ruined cities were as nothing to me in my fantastic advancing. I recovered epochs, gold of former ages that melted in my hands and became toothpaste or hazy vanished citadels. I dreamed exclusively for you. I was told not to make important decisions. This was perfect. I never wanted to. On the hard true surface of my emotions, your ideas sank in so I could play again. But something was happening. You gave me an ideal of conversation, entirely about me, but including almost everything else in the world. But this wasn't poetry. It was something else. After 2 years of spending time in you, years in which I gave my best thoughts to you and always felt you infiltrating and invigorating my feelings, 2 years at 5 days a week, I had to give you up. It wasn't my idea. I think you are nearly through, Dr. Lowenstein said. You seem much better. But light, comedy, tragedy, energy, science, balance, breath. I didn't want to leave you. I cried. I sat up. I stood up. I lay back down. I sat. I said, but I still get sore throats and have hay fever. And someday you are going to die. We can't cure everything. Psychoanalysis. I stood up like someone covered with light as with paint and said, thank you, thank you. It was only one moment in a life, my leaving you. But once I walked out, I could never think of anything seriously for 15 years without also thinking of you. Now what have we become? You look the same, but now you're a past you. That's 50s clothing you're wearing. You have some 50s ideas left, about sex, for example. What should we do? Go walking? We're liable to have a slightly frumpy look, but probably no one will notice. Another something I didn't know then. The next poem is called To Testosterone. I mention in it a place in Rome, the Spanish Steps, which are these beautiful Baroque steps rising from the Piazza di Spagna, which were, at least when I was in Rome, a place for men and women to go to pick each other up, usually travelers. To Testosterone. You took me to the Spanish Steps. Then we walked up to the top of them and looked down. Having looked down from there, we walked down to about the middle of the curving Spanish steps and for a moment sat down, but there was nothing doing. Some cigarette packages lay on the nearby step tops. The sides were a beige white running up and down. No woman in sight. And no one getting in our way either to rouse you from your sleep of 20 centuries, the one you always fall into, and nothing to wake me up either. Although I was completely awake in the banal sense of knowing where the post office was in the Piazza di Spagna, that was just below. Not far, the Piazza del Popolo held the possibility of people, but, I thought, less promisingly than where we were might do. We stayed on the Spanish steps till almost 10. I talked to a few people, you slept, and then went sadly home. The next day, however, you were very lively. You got up before I did and bought the railroad tickets that would take us to Naples. Come on, let's go, you said. But I was barely awake. Be calm. But only to act or to sleep is my nature, you say. Let's use the tickets, take the train, forget this random tune, and get something done. Now leading me to the station, a ravishing Roman girl. Let's stay here, you murmur, when my foot is already on the step of the Stazione Termini. All right, I agree. But my hand is full of tickets and my mind of dismay, confusion and dismay. You have started to make me angry by the way you're making me anxious, which is another thing you do. Stop it, I say. You stop. You appreciate travel the way I appreciate eating lunch. I do remember Barbara in Parma. Exhilaration riding on your horns is never far away. The next poem is called To Jewishness. To Jewishness. As you were contained in or embodied by Louise Schlossman when she was a sophomore at Walnut Hills High School in Cincinnati, Ohio, I salute you and thank you for the fact that she received my kisses with tolerance on New Year's Eve and was not taken aback, as she well might have been, had she not had you and had I not too. Ah, you, dark, complicated you. Jewishness, you are the tray. On it painted Moses, David, and the Ten Commandments, the handwriting on the wall, Daniel in the lion's den, on which my childhood was served by a mother and father who took you to Michigan. Oh, the soft smell of the pine trees of Michigan. And the gentle roar of the lake, Michigan, or sent you to Wisconsin. I went to camp there, on vacation with me, every year. My counselors had you, my fellow campers had you, and Doc Ehrenreich, who ran the camp, had you. We got up in the mornings, you were there. You were in the canoes and on the baseball diamond, everywhere around. At home, growing taller, you thrived too. Louise had you, and Charles had you, and Jean had you, and her sister Mary had you. We all had you, and your Bible full of stories that didn't apply or didn't seem to apply in the soft spring air or dancing or sitting in the cars to anything we did. In religious school at the Isaac M. Wise Synagogue called Temple, we studied not you, but Judaism, the one who goes with you and is your guide, supposedly, oddly separated from you, though there in the same building, you and us children and it on the blackboards and in the books, Bibles and books simplified from the Bible. How like a Bible with shoulders Rabbi Seligman is. You kept my parents and me out of the hotels near Crystal Lake in Michigan, and you resulted for me in insults at which I felt chagrined but was energized by you. You went with me into the army, where one night in a foxhole on Leyte, a fellow soldier said, "Where are the fucking Jews? Back in the PX. I'd like to see one of those bastards out here. I'd kill him." I decided to conceal you. My you. My you, anyway, for a while. Forgive me for that. At Harvard, you landed me in a room in Kirkland House with two other students who had you. You kept me out of the Harvard clubs, and by this time, I was 21, I found I preferred kissing girls who didn't have you. Blonde hair, blue eyes, and Christianity, oddly enough, had an aphrodisiac effect on me. And everything that opened up to me of poetry, of painting, of music, of architecture in old cities didn't have you. I was distressed, though I knew those who had you had hardly had the chance to build cathedrals, write secular epics like Orlando Furioso, or paint annunciations. Well, I had David in the wings. David was a Jew, even a Hebrew. He wasn't Jewish. You're quite something else. I had Mahler, Einstein, and Freud. I didn't want those three then. I wanted Shelley, Byron, Keats, Shakespeare, Mozart, Monet. I wanted Botticelli and Fra Angelico. There you've chosen some hard ones for me to connect to. But why not admit that I gave you the life of the mind as a thing to aspire to? And where did you go to find your freedom? To New York, which was full of me. I do know your good qualities, at least good things you did for me. When I was 10 years old, how you brought Judaism in to give ceremony to everyday things, surprise and symbolism, and things beyond understanding in the synagogue. Then I was excited by you, a rescuer of me from the flatness of my life. But then the flatness got you, and I let it keep you, and perhaps of all things known, that was most ignorant. You sound like Yeats, but you're not. Well, happy voyage home, Kenneth, to the parking lot of understood experience. I'll be here if you need me, and here after you don't need anything else. Here is a quality I have and have had for you and for a lot of others just by being it since you were born. This is to the French language. I needed to find you, and once having found you, to keep you. You who could make me a physical Larousse of everyday living. You who would present me to Gilberte and Anna and Sonia. You by whom I could be a surrealist and a dadaist and almost a fake of Racine and of Molière. I was hiding the heavenly dolor you planted in my heart that I would never completely have you. I wanted to take you with me on long vacations, always giving you so many kisses, ma française, across rocky mountains, valleys, and lakes, and I wanted it to be as if nous faisions ce voyage pour l'éternité et non pas uniquement pour la brève durée d'une année boursière en France. Those days and that idea are gone. A little hotel on the Rue de Fleurus was bursting with you, and one April morning when I woke up, I had you stuck to the tip of my tongue like a Christmas sticker. I walked out into the street, it was Fleurus, and said hello, which came out, "Bonjour, madame." I walked to the crèmerie four doors away and sat down. I was lifted up by you. I knew I couldn't be anything to you but an aspiring lover, sans ego. It was the best relationship of relationships sans ego that I've ever had. I know you love flattery and are so good at it that one can hardly believe what you are saying when it is expressed in you. But I have loved you. That's no flattering statement, but the truth, and still love you, though now I'm not in love with you. The woman who first said this to me nearly broke my heart, but I don't think I'm breaking yours, because it's a cœur in the first place, and for another thing, it beats under le soleil on a jeudi or vendredi matin, and besides, you're not listening to me. At least, not as you did on the days I sat around in Aix-en-Provence's cafes waiting for you to spark a conversation about nothing in particular. I was on stage at all times, and you were the script and the audience. Even when the theater had no people in it, you were there. To consciousness. We didn't pay much attention to you at the barn, though without you, we would probably have been caught. I decided to write one very short one anyway. This is called To Orgasms. You've never really settled down, have you, orgasms? Restless, roving, and not funny in any way, you change consciousness directly, not shift of gears, but changing cars is more like it. I said my prayers, ate lunch, read books, and had you. Someone was there later to join me and you in our festival. Someone was there later to join me and you in our festivity, a woman named Anne. She said, "Oh, we shouldn't do this." I replied, "Oh, we should." We did, and had you. After you, I possess this lovable person, and she possesses me. There is no more we can do. Until the phone rings, and then we start to plan for you again. And it is obvious life may be centered in you. I began to think that every day was just one of the blossoms on the infinitely blossoming tree of life. When it was light out, we'd say, "Soon it will be dark." And when it was dark, we'd say, "Soon it will be light." And we had you. Sometimes we'd be sitting at the table thinking of you or of something related to you and smiled. At other times, might worry. We read a lot of things about you. Some seemed wrong. It seemed puzzling that we had you, or rather that you could have us in a way when you wished to, though we had to wish so too. Ah, like what a wild person to have in the Berkeley apartment. If anyone knew that you were there, but they must have known. You rampaged about. We tried to keep you secret. I mentioned you to no one. What would there be to say? That every night or every day you turned two persons into stone hit by dynamite and rocked them till they rolled just about from bed to floor and then leaped up and got back into bed and troubled you no more for an hour or a day at a time. To marijuana. There is one wonderful moment that I remember when I had smoked you. I was sitting in front of a fire in a fireplace, and I was crazy about a woman, a new, i.e. recently appeared to me, human, so crazy that to show how great I was, it was, unmade I was, it was, I threw my glasses, eyeglasses, into the fire. When I went to look for them sometime after, they were gone, and I was happy, happy as I have ever been. If you could give me such dramatic glances all life long, I'd surely be a pothead, but I also like to wake up in the morning fresh and strong and to write poems with my glasses on. Without them, I'm unable to see. Therefore, I'm not sure what you should be to me, marijuana, in the times that are yet to come, merely a memory. I can remember the hum and the catch in my throat your sensations present to me. I don't know if that's enough. Perhaps occasionally a new bout with you in the name of appetite or love, and occasionally bad, I'd guess, poetry. But then you never know, do you? In any case, thank you for that throwing thing, for that eagle's wing, away from my reasonable beak. To my old addresses. Help, get out of here, go walking. 46, I think, Commerce Street, New York City. The Quai des Brumes, 9426, Paris. Georgia Tech University, Department of Analogues. Wonderland, the stone font, Grimm's Fairy Tales. 48 Greenwich Avenue, the landlady has a dog she lets run use in the courtyard. 7 Charles Street, which Stefan Volpe sublet to me. Hotel de Fleurus in Paris. Via Convincularia in Rome, where the motorcycles speed. 12 Hamley Road in southwest London. Oh, my old addresses, oh, my addresses. Are you addresses still? Or has the hand of time roughed over you and buffered and stuffed you with peels of lemons, limes, and shells from old institutes? If I address you, it is mostly to know if you are well. I'm all right. But I think I will never find sustenance as I found in you, O old addresses, numbers that sink into my soul, 48, 19, 23, O worlds in which I was alive. To the Roman Forum. After my daughter Catherine was born, I was terribly excited. I think I would have been measured at the 25 espresso mark. We, Janice, now Catherine, and I were in Rome. Janice gave birth at the International Hospital on top of Trastevere. I went down and sat and looked at the ruins of you. I gazed at them, gleaming in the half night, and thought, oh my, my God, my goodness, a child, a wife. While I was sitting there, a friend, a sculptor, came by. I just had a baby, I said. I mean, Janice did. I thought I'd look at some very old, great things to match up with this new one. Oh, Adya said, I guess you'd like to be alone then. Congratulations. Good night. Thank you. Good night, I said. Adya departed. Next day I saw Janice and Catherine. Here they are again, and have nothing to do with you. A pure force swept through me another time. I am here, they are here, this has happened. It's happening now, it happened then. To fame. To be known outside one's city and one's nation, to be known outside one's life, by means of you, bella and bruta fama, talk, public opinion. If only you bore more the semblance of recognition of achievement. Instead, you nod and flounce around. You are coanimate with feathers. You traipse off with strangers. You sing the song you've sung thousands of times. At 15, I married my lord, you. I decided I was a poet. You, Shelley, and I went into my later life, and the three of us still stayed separate. I was at my desk, Shelley was in the library, you were out drinking or dancing. I wrote, fame, daughter of Terra, false one and fairest, of all the sisterhood of fake inventions and intentions, come stay with us a while, my friends and me. We have invented a new kind of poetry. What a rush to the heart, and what a rush to the newsstands if you come. But you are gone. One person in a billion perhaps has you forever, and even that person is lifeless, though you promise something else. Norris Embry said to me on Idra one morning, when I was being super sensitive and profound on an unimportant subject, Kenneth, you're Rilking, and there you were. To my 50s. I should say something to you now that you have departed over the mountains, leaving me to my 60s and 70s, not hopeful of your return. Oh, you who seem to mark the end of life, whoever would have thought that you would burn with such sexual fires as you did. I wound up in you some work I had started long before. You were a time for completion and for destruction. My marriage had ended. In you, I sensed trying to find a way out of you, actually, that wasn't toward non-existence. I thought, all over. You cried, I'm here. You were like traveling in this sense, but on one's own, with no tour guide or even the train schedule. As a prime of life, I missed you. You seemed an incompletion made up of completions, unacquainted with each other. How could this be happening, I thought? Or what should it mean exactly that I am 57? I wanted to be always feeling desire. Now you are a young age to me, and in you, as at every other time, I thought that 1 year would last forever. I did the best possible. I lasted my full 10 years. Now I'm responsible for someone else's decade and haven't time to talk to you, which is a shame, since I can never come back. My 50s, answer me one question. Were you the culmination or a phase? Neither and both. Explain. No time. Farewell. Let's see. I don't want to read forever. I'll read three more poems. One, this one's a little longer than the others. It's called To My Heart As I Go Along. I'm sorry you feel lonely. You're hidden, all right, but you're very lively. You give a rat-a-tat-tat to the plainest music. Do you see? Of course you see nothing. I'll make you aware. I mean, how do impressions get down to you, equal, unequal heart, anyway? My nerves send them down, and my brain gives the nerves their perfect instructions. A friend of mine likes women's thighs better than anything. What do you think, heart? I do notice you're beating like anything. What about breasts? What about this old sweetheart? Now you're sad. Well, not exactly. But you give off a slow, thudding beat. Women make you happy and unhappy if those words apply, and so do writing and public recognition. You'd like to be in the body of a well-known and adventurous person, wouldn't you, heart? Meanwhile, you've been battering along, I think, and not for the past few moments paying me much attention. Fear, a little thud in you reminds me. How about fear? Fear is a guest in the villa who heads straight from my room with a razor. So we protect each other. On the top of the mountain, or when I almost fell on the subway tracks, you were there, learning remedial English to say to me, "Watch out." You spoke to me at Yiddish at the fireman's ball, but I couldn't understand you. Look at that horse. Watch out for that oblong, vanquishing woman over there. Do you note that the world has changed since you began your tattoo beneath my chest bone? I would guess that if you do, you don't care. Life is pretty simple, you say, and besides, I have my work to do. I am beating out the rhythm for the whole shebang, besides which, I have more to do than could be guessed at, given the so-called inner life. Heart, it's good to hear you murmuring. By the way, when I was a child, my mother told me I had a heart murmur. Do you remember that? I heard of something. I do remember going to the doctor. He would tap on your chest, but was it a murmur he was looking for? You always say, "I murmur." I guess that would have been a different kind, beating heart. Perhaps walking a few miles would do for you today. Souls uniting one, deft one, roof one, architectural supervisor. Your reactions are so quick sometimes and signals. Little rabbit down there, being in the branches of my blood system, hobo in hiding, track worker, ever up to repairs that may need to be made. Why does the wind blow? Whose cameras are clicking in the leaves? Pit-pat, pit-pat. In North America, I first encountered you by pressing one hand against that part of my chest where I thought you were. Boom, kaboom. That's your heart. Scare. What is it? Do I need it? Can I harm it? Can I lose it? How must I take care of it? Would something else be better in its place? What is the good of it? Is there any bad of it? Is it bigger than someone else's is? Are all of them the same? You were pumping away, of course. I've become used to you. But you still have your surprises. Why are you on my left side, for example? The audience sees it as the right side. Still, it's stage left. You give prestige to that hemisphere of the body. So thud, we go along, thud, an example of unity and disunity in one. Or like Ostia Antica or Pompeii, a city and not a city, a dump and not a dump, present and past together, with thuds for liaison. I sometimes feel my life too cautious and circumstance-laden, and I want to be incendiary like you. No, you don't want that. I'm too repetitive. My work is too repetitive. Let's talk of something else. Perhaps of your student days in Aix-en-Provence at the Chevalier's house. Okay. One dark green light afternoon, Tootsie Chevalier came out of her house to join you as you gained composure on the seat of your bicycle, saying, "Je t'ai apporté à manger," I brought you something to eat. Do you think she loved you just a little bit or not at all? I know that I was beating fairly rapidly during this largely unknown, forgotten event, but not by me. What do you mean, harp? And why do you want to keep gladdening me by entertainments? Was this Tootsie you're referring to, the desirable Madeleine? Ay me, I think so. But what did you do but depart and cleanse the afternoon? That night when Eddie came home, he suspected nothing, because there was nothing to suspect. I gave you happiness at the stars then, and sexual entertainment for your blood, almost constantly. You were a great creator and interpreter of dramas, it's true. And when the political events at Columbia got really hot, you were battering in me when I got up to talk at the meeting of old professors to try to dissuade them from going out to stop the community from crossing campus walk. I didn't give you any words, though. You had to think of them yourself. I said, "Stop," mainly. "What are you thinking of?" etc. I remember quieting down but having a few good beats from that afterwards, too. You were with me in the army when I thought some enemy soldier was moving outside my tent. It turned out just to be a duck. I remember being excited. You hammered. And now you're hammering once again. Oh, I have the reactions all right, but it's you who give them to me, even by this curious talk we're having today, which rattles me forward, sideways, and back, till I hardly know how to stop my agitation. In the days not too unrecent, when lost love was the staple of my life, I heard you coming from smiles, from frowns, from telephone calls away. Your roar was deafening. What I think now is that if I seek you a little bit by swimming, by reading, by traveling, even by some mild flirtation, it is to keep you down, contented, not saving up all your energy to consume my whole well-being with a bomb. Heart, you can be frightening. Once again, I have to tell you, the doer isn't I, it's you. Liar, collaborator, friend. We'll drink some coffee on this hot afternoon and see what then. The night promises to be cooler, and Orion may find Orso in his den of brilliance, as beneath my breastbone I found you. The last poem I'll read is called To Old Age. What comes at the end of it is a quotation from the French poet St. John Peirce, who wrote this wonderful phrase, Grand âge, nous voici, which means old age, here we are. To old age. You hurried through my 20s as if there were nowhere to look for what you were searching for. Perhaps my first trip to China. You said, I love that country because they love everything that's old and they like things to look old. Take the fortune cookies, for example, or the dumplings, or the universe's shining face. I said, chopsticks don't look old. But you were hurrying past me, past my love, my uncomprehended marriage, my 9 or 10 years nailed in the Valley of the Fools. And still you were not there, wouldn't stop there. You disappeared for a year that I spent in Paris, came back to me in my father's face, and later in my mother's conversation. You seemed great in the palm trees during a storm, and lessened by the boat's preceding clops. Looking at a gun or at a tiger, I never thought I was standing facing you. You were elsewhere, rippling the sands, or else making some boring conversation among people who scarcely knew each other. You were left by Shelley to languish, and by Byron, and by Keats. Shakespeare never encountered you. What are you, old age, that some do and some do not come to you? Are you an old guru who won't quit talking to us in time for us to hang up the phone? You scare me half to death, and I suppose you will take me there too. You're a companion of green ivy and stumbling vines. If I could break away from you, I would, but there's no light down in that gulch there. Walk with me then. Let's not be falling this fiery morning. Grand âge, nous voici. Old age, here we are. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.